Okay. Yes, it was a challenge. I picked this title because with all the surprises that you have undoubtedly heard about in the Exoplanets game, you think nothing was expected, then what have the theorists been doing? So you're tempted to answer the question, they've been playing it poorly. And in fact, that's we had Scott Tremaine here earlier. He was my PhD thesis advisor. And paraphrasing his three laws of planet formation, it goes like this. Law number one is, theory tells us that planets cannot form. Law number two is, all the theories are wrong. And law number three is, these two statements are compatible with the observations. Okay. All right, so I call it a game because it is fun. It's very fast moving. There's lots of results to try to react to. And it's mostly played observationally, I would say. And so then I just think about, why are we having a meeting here to talk about exoplanet theory when it's been trailing, trying to play catch up and explaining observations as they're made. Now, I want to change the perspective a little bit and hope to show you examples where some main ideas, really important ideas, were anticipating what the discoveries were. And I would say still you cannot believe any of the really detailed calculations, and I'll suggest a reason why at the end. But generally speaking, I would say that there is a role in this game to be played by theorists, and so we'll talk about some of the interesting problems here. So if it's observationally driven, what are those results? Well, we have, I know there's a diverse audience here. Not everybody's been thinking about this for 9 weeks, so I'll just tell you some of the important results are that about half of Sun-like stars have a planet, and they are generally, most of the planets are small relative to Jupiter and Saturn. There's a logarithmic distribution. In planet radius, it looks from Kepler results like between about 1 and 3 Earth radii are roughly flat. So this is number. There's a logarithmic axis, so I'll put 10 here, and then it steeply declines. And so we have a whole lot more rocky and gas poor bodies than we do gas giants. So Uranus and Neptune live here at 4. They're about 10% by mass in hydrogen and helium. And of course, Jupiter and Saturn are dominated by gas by mass. All right.
Is there an error bar, sort of? I mean,
yeah, there's a huge error bar. So one of the benefits of the chalk talk I've realized is that
you don't have to put error bars.
That's right. You can just draw the plot how you envision, or how the observational results as you want to portray them. So this is all I really want to say about that. Just that there's a lot more planets at small sizes. About half the stars have those kinds of planets, and only about 15% of stars have gas giants.
What is the lower cutoff on your horizontal scale?
About 1. The error bar goes to about factor unity below 1, so that's why I didn't plot it.
Oh, okay. There's a lot of tiny stuff.
So, we just don't know how many tiny planets there are.
Okay. Yes. I heard the speculation from people in your program that 100% of stars may have planets.
Right.
You're saying?
No, that's speculation.
Okay. So this is what we know for sure. It's a bound, you'd say?
There's two main probes of this, radial velocity and transit. And both of them have been coming in with numbers of around 50%. And that's people, depending on their focus, can pitch it different ways. So one thing that we know from transits, the best thing that we know from transits is the number of planets per star. For M-dwarf stars, that seems like it's more, maybe around 1. For sun-like stars, it's a little bit more like 50%. So if you if your perspective is M stars are the most populous in the galaxy, and therefore they dominate, then that's what you talk about. So I just want to say 50% because you shouldn't think of every star having a planet for sure. Certainly stars that have a binary companion nearby have thrown out all their companion planets. All right, so...
Is that conclusive then? Can I tell my students that not all suns have a planet then? Or is it, or there's still error bars that...
Pushing too hard.
Yeah, you're pushing too hard.
Are half the stars binary?
Yeah, so there are plenty of planets in binary systems. I'm just talking about there can't be a planet around the same orbit as a star. It'll kick out. It's a pretty trivial statement. So many of the low-mass planets have these gaseous atmospheres. You cannot get to 3 and certainly not up to 4 Earth radius. This is an Earth. Can't get up to 4 Earth radius with just rock. It has to have some gas on top. So we also know that the gas giants in particular are associated with metal-rich stars, meaning not just all the elements besides hydrogen and helium in the atmosphere of the star. That's a predictor for whether a gas giant planet will be found around that star. And another important observation is that the orbital periods span the whole observable range. As close to the star as a planet can get without getting ripped apart or falling in, and very far from the star, further than we've seen for the solar system, like 100 AU. All right, so one role of the theorists in this game has been to come up with interesting observational programs, and that's undeniably an important way that theory has played the exoplanet game, such as in 2005, there were a few papers talking about how transit timing variations could find small planets, and that's been a focus of mine, characterizing planets by how they perturb one another, and that's seen in transit. Another one was in 1991, 1992, before planets were found by radial velocity, people suggested that you could find them by gravitational microlensing. So you two stars line up, and the background star is lensed, and it probes whether the foreground star has planets or not. And that's been a really neat method and successful method of finding planets. Another way theorists have played is that they compute structure models and atmosphere models to interpret observations. So that's not all. All of that theory is great, but it's not really the core theory that I want to talk about, which is theories of formation and evolution. So because we're in an institute for theory, that's kind of the basic question: can the planets be there, and what properties should they have? Not how to detect them specifically. So in my opinion, the community has gotten into trouble when trusting those theories too explicitly and not just taking away the first blush look at it. So let me tell you some of the first blush things. So in the solar system, we have several different isotope systems that tell us different timescales. During the program, we heard about some of them. So the solar system is 4.5 billion years old. But the objects in the solar system from the earliest days seem to have formed quite quickly. Planetesimals between 1 and 2 million years. And this is set by radioactive nucleides that decay on that timescale. So aluminum-26, for instance. We know that some of the smaller asteroids were able to differentiate, so that suggests that aluminum-26 with a 0.7 megayear half-life melted the thing and caused iron to go to the center, and that gives us iron meteorites. So that's a really important constraint. So we definitely need to form planetesimals first, and the reason I say that is because this number distribution suggests that small planets are made on the way to making big planets, and so only a small fraction of the small planets grow up and become big planets. And so if you look at that, you think, well, You've got to start small and grow big. So that's why people are interested in planetesimals. Okay. So I'm going to... There's also observations of disks themselves. They last around 3 million years, and that has big error bars. From disk to disk, it's different. So what's observed is mainly the dust that exists around newborn stars, and different clusters have different ages. So the observations show that most of the stars have a dust disk at one mega year in age, and then they die off, and only 10% have a disk by 10 million years, something like that. So we don't really know how long the solar system's disk lasted, but we have objects in the solar system that formed very quickly in this history. Any questions so far? Okay. Thanks for the early interruptions. Keep it up. So let's talk first about, I'm going to talk about three different things and try to glean just three basic principles from them. So here I'll write glean from theory. Try to have some takeaway lessons. Okay, so the first one I want to talk about is movement in a disk. So this is the biggest challenge to planet formation, because the dust that comes along from the interstellar medium in the gas forming around the star grows within the gas disk just by condensing from the gas onto the dust. So the dust grows a little bit. It also collides and sticks together. However, there's a big problem around 1 meter, so it's called a boulder drift. It's aerodynamic drag, and we heard about this last week from Ruth Marie Clay. She told us about aerodynamic drag, and that means that there's a pressure gradient in the gas that's not present for the solids, and so the gas orbits a little bit slower than the solids. The very small solids, much less than 1 meter, will just be entrained in the gas and float along in the gas, whereas the very big ones, like 100 meters or 1,000 meters, they will be decoupled from the gas. They just plow right through it and don't feel it. But around 1 meter is a really important part where they slow down as they orbit. So in one orbit, they can encounter their own mass of gas and therefore slow down really dramatically. So the time scale for in spiral is about 100 years at 1 AU for 1 meter solids. So that's really disconcerting, and that's the primary problem for forming planetesimals. Yeah, changing their semi-major axis by order unity. So this is a good question. This is a good stopping point to say, all right, but how far can it go at that time scale? And pretty much the current best guess, in my opinion, is that there's just collective effects that take over, in which many bodies stream together and flock, sort of pushing away, so that the individual members are pushing away the gas more easily. So now this requires that there's been lots of simulations of this collective behavior, as you can imagine, and it's been shown that it requires a lot of the gas is depleted compared to the dust, and by a factor of 3 or something. So the flocking behavior only triggers when there's less gas per dust. So I just heard a talk on Friday about how this might be achieved by grain growth, the dust settling a little bit, and then the top of the disk, like the exterior of the disk in the vertical direction, being photo evaporated more readily. So that can give you a higher dust to gas ratio and cause the trigger for collective behavior. So so I'll just put a question mark here. Don't really know if that's the solution. But I would say that this solution was already thought of way before exoplanets were found. It was Goldreich and Ward, 1973, who proposed this. And so they were not terribly they computed some backup calculations about what happens if the collective effects can fail, if the dust can stir back up into the gas. And they also computed, even though one would spiral in this time, if they act collectively, they still spiral in at some time scale, because you have a layer of gas and then, a layer of dust and then a layer of gas above it, and there's an interface that would cause a torque. So that was more like 10 to the 5 years. So in that time scale, you'd need to have these clumps of dust form into planetesimals. All right? And then the second one, even if you can get to a planetesimal, which is usually thought of as kilometer size, how much, there's another effect when you've gotten to planet size, and that's called type 1 migration, or what are they right here, disk migration.
Can I just ask a question about the gas dust situation? Is it modeled also at the level of, you know, the chemistry and the ion fraction and sort of at that level of microphysics? Because I just
some of it, yeah.
To what extent the gas sort of might accrete to the dust and just build up dust by its own sort of photochemical problems?
I don't know the literature that well. Does someone know all of these? Has that been addressed? Certainly the turbulence in the disk has been addressed by, and that depends on the ionization fraction, for instance, through magnetic effects. Doug?
The gross issue has been addressed.
Okay. these other effects that he mentioned?
The detailed chemistry probably has not been, but the gross issue has been.
Okay. All right, so what about disk migration? That's a concept we also heard about from Ruth last week. And the issue is that it was foreseen again by, this time by, again, Goldreich and Tremaine in 1980. They wrote a paper inspired by trying to understand satellites in the disk of around Saturn. And so they wanted to know how fast does a satellite move and as it interacts with the disk. So they, at the end of the paper, they did a calculation about Jupiter in the solar nebula and came up with a time scale of about 10 to the 4 years for Jupiter migrating through the solar nebula. And again, this is a instantaneous tau. What is the effect? It's that as the gas passes Jupiter, it gets kicked and exchanges angular momentum with Jupiter. And so gas going one way kicks it, causes a torque that pushes Jupiter the other way and vice versa. And so what Goldreich and Tremaine said was they calculated one time scale 10 to the 3 years and then said, but there's canceling torques on either side and there's some gradient in the disk property. So about an order of magnitude less is how fast you'd expect. So came up with 10 to the 4 years. Now, so they already recognized what I think has been the solution to this problem for exoplanets, which is that the disk structure matters. Thermal effects matter, and also just the run density as a function of distance really matters for calculating where the planets go, not just if they go. So that's kind of the backup. So both of these, I would say, the details were not at all clear when the original calculations were made. But the upshot was that planets can move. And I think that's where observers should have stopped paying attention, sort of, and just taken it as an axiom that we have some mechanisms that can move planets around. So here, gleaned from theory, I'll just put not near birthplace.
they can move in both inward and outward.
Yes. So you, observers should look everywhere. One thing observers have to...
They tend to do that at higher levels.
Yeah, but they still often need encouragement from the theorists to tell them this is a reasonable place to look. So I'll tell a story, and maybe Jeff can contradict this. But I think the initial radial velocity observers were specking out their observations by wanting to see Jupiter. So you guys took cadences appropriate to see Jupiter and only did a real big survey until you got the precision required to see Jupiter. And based on seeing binary stars with very short orbital periods, Mayor and company looked at three-day cadence and found a three-day planet. So they were just, I don't know how much of this they had heard from the theorists that planets can move around, but that was the observation strategy that paid off big time. So, yeah. Anything to add to that? Okay, yeah.
It's got hydrodynamic question. So, you're saying after 3 million years or so, I don't have to worry about hydrodynamics anymore.
Right. So that thus begins the second part of the talk. Well, sort of.
And before 3 million years, even if I turn gravity off, 2D hydrodynamics, turbulence, let's say, vortices tend to become bigger vortices. Emerge, unlike three-dimensional turbulence where you have a Kolmogorov cascade, which means that the energy goes to smaller scales. In 2D turbulence, like a disk, it would go the other way, one would think.
I'm going to defer to some of my colleagues here.
Can that play a role?
There is shear from the different orbital periods spinning at different rates. Hubert, what would you say about that?
So you're right. On the big picture, it's two-dimensional turbulence. But eventually, when one scales down, that also then the height matters again. And then you can have three-dimensional instabilities in this two-dimensional large-scale vortex, elliptic instability, so that they have some limit in their size. Okay. And then they are also affected by other hydrodynamical effects, like magnetic fields, which may destroy them. So. But we also have good belief that there, for some time, there are vortices around, and they play around in this triggering of collective effects, hopefully.
Okay. A typical aspect ratio in these disks is 10 to 1. The height is about a tenth the distance. Okay. So that means you can't, it does become a 3D problem deep in the disk. All right. And then one thing that was expected from this idea that planets move around, actually inspired, again, by the satellite observations of natural satellites, is that planets might capture into resonances with each other as they move towards one another. A 2-to-1 resonance, for instance, could overtake another planet or another satellite. So we see around Jupiter a bunch of resonances. And so that was expected for exoplanets and was, I would say, gloriously observed for gas giants. In around 2000, now there's about 10 systems where there are gas giants that are in resonance with each other. So that's one of the biggest successes of disk migration, in my opinion. And then another counteracting prediction was that the smaller planets should not be in resonance, and that was by Adams, Laughlin, and Block. And what they said was disks have some turbulence and they tend to kick around the planets a little bit. And a gas giant planet, the ones that were observed up to that point in 2008, the gas giant planets have resonances that are strong enough and wide enough to withstand all this kicking and be damped. Whereas the smaller planets have thinner resonances, which are more susceptible to breaking in the face of this kicking. So they predicted that mean motion resonances should be rare among the lower mass planets, and that has been observed. So let me show you. I'll draw over here the... here we go. So you have the number of pairs as a function of the orbital period ratio. Now I'll just draw it one here means they're right on top of each other. We don't see any planets sharing the same orbit, although there are some satellites that do. I'm drawing the important places here. Okay, so the closest ones are around 1.16, and so there's a peak here, and then it falls off. And this is based on multi-transiting systems from the Kepler spacecraft, and so it's measured about I think it's about 500 systems of multiple planets, all a few planets transiting the same star, and then you just measure their orbital periods from the spacing of the dips and take the ratio. So it's each one is known quite precisely. And now I get to use my artistic license and drawing on the blackboard to show you what features I want to emphasize. So in general, it's quite broad. There is a selection effect because even if the two planets are coplanar, the inner planet might transit, whereas the outer planet does not. So as the planets are wider from each other, it's more likely that you'll miss those systems. So if you want to know the intrinsic distribution, you have to multiply by some factor. And that tends to broaden it out like this. Well, I won't go down so sharply because we don't know if it goes down very sharply or not. But there's a broad peak between 1.5 and 2 orbital period, the ratio here. And for comparison, the solar system spans between about 1.6 and 3 in period ratio. I'm not counting for the asteroid belt, pretending the asteroid belt is a planet. So here's the solar system. All right, so that's interesting. We have a really broad distribution. Now, I haven't drawn any spikes, probability spikes at the resonances, because this detection technique was sensitive to all the small planets. And so it found mostly the small planets, which in fact are not in resonance. But around 1.5, there does seem to be a peak that's about a factor of 2 higher than the baseline. And there might be a little deficit, just narrow of the resonance. Whereas at 2, there's a funny kind of redistribution. There's fewer planets narrow of the resonance, and they seem to be piled up just wide of it. So these effects seem to have... This suggests to me, since it's like a perturbation on a baseline, that the planets were just thrown down and then redistributed here. And there's some mechanisms like tides and planetesimal scattering that has been proposed for that. This might be something. This might be a signature of migrating into resonance. So anyway, I'm just saying that there's some good data now on pairs of planets, and they point towards these things.
About, a question about migration. Multiple yeah. transit. I'm assuming that in most cases you're not seeing any given planet go around more than one transit.
We are, in fact. A lot of their orbital periods are about 10 days, and the data span 4 years.
10 days.
10 days. Okay, so let me say that the theory should have inspired the observers to look at all sorts of orbital periods. The first planets that were found were at 3 days. So really just 10 times the size of the star. And there's so far it's an observational reality that most of the space that is accessible to observations has been populated with planets. So it seems like the gas giants are more populous beyond 1 AU, but there's still plenty of gas giants within 1 AU. And the small planets, the best techniques have only been able to probe within tens of days of the star in large numbers. But yeah, that's where those planets are. That's how we know these period ratios precisely. All right.
You actually have no observational data on the full range of orbits on the
range. Yeah, I didn't think about preparing this, but there's the distribution, semi-major axis, in sun-to-earth units. we have that's about the full range that have been attempted to have been observed. And we have mass of the planet here in Earth masses. So 300 is Jupiter. And let's put one down here. No method has gotten, well, there's a specialized method with pulsars that's gotten down below one Earth, but not many methods have. So this is 10 Jupiters. And so, yeah, radial velocity technique has spanned. You can see above this line. So what it means is the star is oscillating due to the planet orbiting around it. And in the shortest orbital periods of about 3 days, you can see a one Earth mass planet around some bright stars. So those have been found. And the first planets that were found are up here in the few Jupiter range at about 3 days. And then quickly on its heels came planets closer to 1 AU, also of Jupiter's mass. Now the transit technique has seen out to about 1 AU, and not beyond that because you do require several transits to see it. So the transit technique has seen slightly smaller planets out to 1 AU. And then there's the microlensing technique I mentioned, which has seen some 10 Earth mass planets around a couple of AU, so in here. So microlensing is sensitive like that. Okay, so that's the observational picture.
There's direct imaging to the very far right.
Yes, yeah. So direct imaging is only probed down to about Jupiter. Let's see, it only goes into about 20 AU. So in principle, direct imaging could see out very, very far. And I think that's one direction for exploration is looking very, very, having very big fields around near, not so nearby stars so that you can probe out to 10 to the 4 AU around those stars and see if planets live there. Okay, so the next topic I want to address is gasless planet formation from instabilities that result in formation. So I want to you to recognize at the end that an unstable system is one that's still forming. So that's kind of unintuitive that you'd think that formation is a concept where you need nice stable things, but it's not really. So one numerical experiment that's been done is putting a bunch of planets in orbit around a star and asking, and put them on circular orbits around the star, and ask how long does that system stay on rather circular orbits without the orbits starting to cross. And so the scale of interest here is called the Hill sphere, and it's you get it by comparing the tide from the star, how much the star keeps two planets apart compared to how much they attract each other. And so then, here, I'll put the star way over here. So the semi-major axis is A, and the distance between the two I'll call delta A. And so instability sets in immediately if if this beta is 1, so the two planets will just come by and have a huge deflection on a single orbit as they pass each other. But the numerical experiments I'm talking about vary this beta between about 1 and 10. and ask how many orbits does this assembly of planets last. And so you have T instability versus beta. And so what I want to draw here is just 10 orbits, a beta of 3 will go unstable in 10 to the 4 orbits. In 10 to the 4 orbits, beta of 5 will go unstable. 10 to the 7 orbits is beta of 8. And then it sort of turns up after that. All right, so what do I imagine? I imagine that coming out of the gas disk, there's medium-sized embryos, they're called, and they have a certain mass, and given that mass and their orbital separation, they have a certain beta. And this corresponds to a certain time scale that they'll go unstable. Now, what I'm going to do is a little bit funny, but there's a grain of truth in it, so I'm trying to get to the grain. So we have the mass of a planet, let's say 0.1 times the mass of the Earth, and that's Mars's mass, in fact. And let's start them out spaced by 0.02 AU, which turns out to be a beta of 3. So this is right down here, and it'll go unstable right away in just 10 orbits. So when that happens, I'm imagining that these two planets will merge, these two planets will merge, these two will merge, and then we'll set up a new system. So when you have an instability, the planets just hit each other. The reason for this is that their escape velocity is much smaller than their orbital velocity. So you know, the escape velocity from the surface of a planet is 2 times gm over r. So you could think of the escape velocity from their orbit around the star, and you would just plug in their semi-major axis for r and the mass of the star for m. Or you could think of the escape velocity from the surface of each other, and then you would put the mass of the planet here and the radius of the planet here. So for the Earth, the escape velocity from the surface is 11 kilometers per second, whereas escape velocity from the orbit of the Earth is 40-something kilometers per second. So it's about a factor of 3. So what that means is the Earth has a lot of trouble kicking you out of the solar system. If you're a satellite flying by it, that's not a good way to be slingshot out of the solar system. Now, I say slingshot because Jupiter does this to satellites that we want to send to the outer planets, for instance. It's a good idea to send them really close to Jupiter and have Jupiter kick them. And so Jupiter, having a much bigger escape velocity and a much bigger semi-major axis, it's natural that it can kick out. But for this kind of system, when they go unstable, the planets are just going to kick each other a little bit and eventually hit each other. So yeah, that first generation will just merge, and you get twice the mass, as I've drawn it here, twice the distance between them. And now beta is about 5. So 10 to the 4 here. So now, having that one merger, they've grown up a little bit, and they'll take longer till the next merger. And you can see the pattern here. The next mergers, as they hierarchically grow, we'll put the beta out at 7.5. So that's 3 × 10⁶ years. All right, now these first two, you can see, are a bit fictitious because I said the disk lasts 3 million years. So does the disk go away in 10 years and set this up? No, not really. They're going to start doing this action while the disk is present. And so it's just a... So the transition from the gas to the gas-free will be delicate. You'll have to calculate that. But by the time you're some fraction of the Earth, there's plenty. And I just picked this for illustration purposes. By the time you're a fraction of the Earth, then you can last, you can stay stable for longer than the gas disk. So now we're to Venus and Earth's masses, and 0.16. And now beta is 12. And the simulations have not been run long enough to see what happens there, but there seems to be a turn up around 9. So what that means is for longer, much longer than the age of the solar system, this a system with this spacing on circular orbit should last. All right. In all that merging, they don't really regain circular orbits each time. Like I've suggested, you could use this plot. They really are left with eccentric orbits after the planets merge with one another. So what we have in the solar system now is a bunch of eccentricities that are a bit uncomfortably high for stability. And in fact, the terrestrial planets of the solar system are formally chaotic on 5 million-year timescales. So that means that nearby initial conditions diverge, and we cannot predict the history of the system beyond I think going back in the past, it's been very hard to get back to when the dinosaurs ruled. So that would be like 12 Lyapunov enough times or something like that. So we don't know where the planets were back then. And so going forward in the future, we don't know what's going to happen to them either. Calculations have been done of ensembles of solar systems, and seeing that you get Mercury has something dramatic happen to it in about 1% of forward integrations. So that's interesting that Mercury will either hit the sun, be ejected, or hit another planet in 1% of forward integrations. Now, that's kind of interesting that the solar system isn't dead stable, but what's more interesting to me is that it's that stable. That apparently only 1% of future integrations kill off a planet. And
what time scale?
That's the thing. These integrations have run for 5 billion years, which is when the sun becomes a red giant. So the same as the current system age, yet there's only a 1% chance of one of them going unstable. So if this story about instability and formation leading to one another is to hold up, we need to understand that somehow. There's certainly no anthropic reason why the solar system shouldn't go unstable in the future. So why is it so stable to so that I guess the time scale you'd compute is 100 times longer than the current age? One idea that's been proposed is that the planets in forming kick off some extra. They kick off secondary debris as they hit each other, and that secondary debris can damp. There's enough of it for it to collisionally damp, and then that soaks up some of the eccentricity from the orbits. Now, if that's true, I would like to use it to understand the closest in systems here. There's a system here called Kepler 36, and it's a system of a 4 and an 8 Earth mass planets. The 8 Earth mass planet has gas on top. About 5% of its mass is in gas. And they exist at this location, which is really on the far extreme of the distribution, and it's only marginally stable. The observations are consistent both with it going unstable and with it staying stable for a long time. But in either case, it's very close to the instability limit. And the idea here might be that you have the two planets that start scattering off each other and have a close approach. And when they do that, the close approach will generally... So if they merge together, then you'll get something that's relatively circular. But since one of the planets has, its structure is kind of like this. It has a rocky or icy core, and then another factor of two in radius is gas. And that's only 5% by the mass, is in hydrogen and helium. So it could be that this other planet passed through this envelope and kicked off some of the gas into orbit around the star. So then the planets, even though they've finished formation, you would think, and the gas disk is cleared away, the gas that was on top of the planet is now orbiting around the star. And that can just decouple the two planets, because as they're scattering off each other, they feel the gas, and that causes their orbits to circularize. And that could cause them to decouple a little bit and no longer be unstable. So that's an idea for instability leading to formation and then final close orbit of this system. All right. The thing to glean from this part, I would just say, is what we should look for is the stars of instability. Scars of instability. Because formation is by instability, and therefore the planets that have formed should have scars. And I said Jupiter causes ejections, not only mergers. In so doing, it leaves the surviving planet quite eccentric. And so that was another one of the first surprises of exoplanets, was that the planets were much more eccentric than the planets of the solar system. And that's been the main way of understanding that. Yes?
Would you say the rotation axis of Uranus is a scar of?
Yep, that's the next topic. So I'll go through this one quickly. Inclinations. So Uranus is tilted over 98 degrees. And the usual way of understanding that is that, yeah, some big body, maybe about Earth size, hit it off axis, and that caused it to tilt. So inclinations. So Kant and Laplace saw the couple of degrees of mutual inclinations between orbits as evidence that the solar system formed in a gas disk. And that's pretty much held up. Except I would say there's these anomalies which is that the sun has an obliquity of 6 degrees relative to the plane. So the planets seem to agree with each other more than the spin axis of the star does with the planets. Jupiter is nearly aligned, but not quite. Saturn is quite misaligned. As just mentioned, Uranus and Neptune are misaligned as well. Okay, so this suggests that something was going down in the early solar system which tilted things. Now, gas giants should form aligned, because you have the star and the growing planet, and you have gas flows. So it's orbiting this way, and we'll go into its reference frame. So its interior orbits are catching up to it, and exterior orbits are being caught up by it. And as those flow into the Hill sphere of the planet, they turn around and become a disk that orbits in the same direction as, that spins in the same direction as the planet orbits. So that's how we think the planets got their gas, is through accretion streams that took motions like this. And so it's natural to think that they should be aligned, yet you see that some of them are misaligned. So hitting Uranus is one way. Another way was suggested before exoplanets were discovered, and again by Scott Tremain. This one in 1991, he said that as stars form, gas flows come in from all sorts of directions. So that can torque the system that's already there, the gas disk which is already laid down, and it can also by accreting onto the star, reset the orientation of the star. All right, so we have a distribution of obliquities from other stars. And this is, I won't go into the observational side, but we have a certain angle lambda, which is like stars spinning upright like that, and then the planet comes along, and the orbit normal to the planet is misaligned by lambda. And so about 5 years ago when we had the last KITP meeting on exoplanets, there was the discovery of misaligned planets. And at the time, you had, as a function of effective temperature of the star, I'll explain why that in a minute, you had two categories. One were the cool planets. So there were two exceptions to this. Cooler stars, rather. This is the effective temperature of the star. And then there were more misalignments for the hotter stars. All right, so I had constructed theories of how to tilt planets around. After the planet forms, I had a theory that said that you should get a distribution like this for this this lambda angle. And in particular, most of the planets should be prograde relative to the star and not orbiting retrograde. About 80% should be prograde. So what was found was that it seemed to depend on stellar temperature, which my theory did not. And also, more than 80% seemed to be retrograde. So that suggests that
you mean
this detailed...
You meant prograde. More than 80%?
Say that again?
More than 80%?
Oh, fewer than 80% were prograde is what I meant.
Got it.
Yeah. So it was more isotropic than the theories of post-formation suggested. All right, so right now Ruth and I were thinking of the last few weeks how to characterize this distribution more. Originally when it was published, this seemed like a really strict dividing line in stellar temperature, and it had to do something with the star. Now it looks like there's some blurring here. There's some prograde ones beyond this line, and there are about 20% isotropic over here. So what it looks like is that there's a fraction of misaligned systems, which does vary as a function of stellar type, but maybe not so steeply. The best fit says that about 20% are misaligned over here, and there's a rise to about consistent with 100% over here, and that transition happens. The best fit transition is between about 6100 and 6500. So this would correspond to a stellar mass change of only about 30%. So this is the best fit, but the data are also consistent with a pretty broad transition over 1,000 K or more. So that would be consistent with some change in star formation over a factor of 2 in stellar mass, causing the stars that are more massive than about 1.3 solar masses to be isotropically oriented relative to their planets. And the lower mass stars, like half of, the data only go down to about half a solar mass. So about half a solar mass to 0.8 solar masses, those ones are usually aligned with their planets. So we still haven't really gotten the main idea of why different mass stars would obey their disks more religiously, but this is the current idea, to try to connect some of these observations of misalignment back to the star formation and disk implanting disks around stars.
For systems for multi transit systems,
even for the hot, do we have any hotter stars with multi-transit systems? And there, is the planetary plane still aligned? And that's... Yeah. In fact, this is why we picked it up again. So most of these observations were for hot Jupiters, meaning that they're usually alone. They're a single planet. And if there are other planets, you have no idea if the whole system's messed up or what. What was found by Svi Mazzi and reported that at this program was that for some of the Kepler multi-systems, where you have multiple planets transiting, and therefore they're probably close, the planets themselves are coplanar, he found the same trend that the hotter stars tend to be misaligned, and the cooler stars tend to be aligned. And that was a very the paper was very statistical in nature, so it couldn't dig down deep into the details. But the main point is that even for small planets and even for coplanar planets, even for more distant planets where tides with the star don't matter, any of that business, it still seems to matter. So there still seems to be an effective temperature difference.
Excuse me, could it play a role that the hotter stars are on the average younger?
On the average younger. Okay, so over time, it damps out. So I suppose that's possible. So I think what we'll do now is just try to characterize the observations more, what this transition looks like, and for what kinds of planets it's relevant to. It seems like all planets at the moment. So I don't know how the star would reorient with any planets as a function of time, even if they're small and distant. So the last thing I'll write down here is that what we need is initial conditions from star formation. So I think to make progress in the theory of exoplanets, we need to hear from the theory and observation of star formation, because to get at some of these questions, you just need to know how to set up the system and press go in the theory sense. All right, thank you.
More questions?
You mentioned there's a lot of planets you observed in very tight orbits.
Yes.
Which rather suggests that there must have been a lot of cases where planets were too close to the star and spiraled in.
Right.
And I'm wondering whether that would be expected to give any observational signature of it happening, and whether that would give any hints about the formation process.
Mm-hmm. This has been discussed quite a lot. I don't know of any dedicated surveys that have looked for it. What I would naively expect is that you should look at young stars, because the instabilities progress over lots of ranges of timescales. So you're more likely to throw something into the star in the first, you're way more likely to throw it in the first half of the age of the star than the second half. And of course, they will fall in when the star becomes a red giant. So there's another opportunity for you. But I think the main observational problem is that star formation is already known to be a very episodic and messy process where it's hard to distinguish. Well, first of all, the stars are behind a veil of gas and dust, so it's hard to observe. Secondly, there are variability on those young stars, and so it might be hard to tell that it's a planet that's hitting the star at a certain time. Dmitri?
You mentioned before that there are 10 resonant gas giant planets and 0 terrestrial planets. So that's a good correlation. But the fact remains there are only 10 resonant planets. Right? I think a lot of people in the exoplanet yep. community say, "Oh, there are many resonant planets," and you see this in papers all the time.
Right.
But there are very few, and I wonder if that actually says something about our thinking, our knowledge of disk migration, because we see in tens of percent of all disk migration simulations, how you can capture planets quite easily in resonance. And so I wonder,
the simulations start close to resonance and then get into resonance.
Right.
So we don't really know how many systems start far from resonance and never get near it? That's right. One comment. And secondly, yeah, you're right. It could be that there were observational reasons for that these are emphasized. And even just as I've drawn things and suppressed some details and brought out other details, you're right that theorists might have latched onto that more strongly than is justified.
Great. Could you say something about resonance of the planetary rotation period itself?
Sure.
Mercury shows such a resonance.
Yeah, and exoplanets, we don't have the spin period of any planet yet. So it has not been addressed. From this concept that the atmosphere of a planet should have been accreted, you'd think that gas giants should be spinning near breakup, and Jupiter and Saturn are only spinning a third of breakup. So this is something that can be probed soon by direct imaging of these gas giants. And it has been, the spin of one planet has been observed, just a rough value, but it's not spinning at breakup, it's slower than breakup.
So number.
This one is met. It's like a line broadening. You have a spectrum of the planet because it's directly imaged and separated from the starlight, and it's at high dispersion. So they were able to see that the lines were not as broad as their instrument. They were a little broader. So that's from rotation. Now, resonance between the planet and the star. I think you're encouraging theorists to try to poke at that before the observers get to it.
Well, I was thinking of infrared, or thermal emission, perhaps, yeah. Because the weather would be different for a planet that's rotation is in resonance with its orbit.
There have been phase curves of planets. The ones that are really close in and hot enough to do that, indeed, you can see that the face that's pointed towards the star is hotter than the backside. And this does fit with models that the planet is spin orbit locked, just like the moon. On average, of course, it has these ones are hot Jupiters, and they have an atmosphere that are flowing around the planet as well. So I guess I'm just saying we don't have very, very good information on that yet. And indeed, we expect tidal locking, even tidal resonances for terrestrial planets.
So you're saying there's no data yet for a terrestrial-type planet in such an orbit.
Right.
Great.